I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 100 of the 166 prisoners being held at Guantanamo are on a hunger strike. 23 of them are being force-fed by tubes that are inserted by Navy medical personnel through their noses and into their stomachs. According to our guest, Carol Rosenberg, four of those who are being force-fed were cleared for release a number of years ago. In fact, according to her reporting, 56 prisoners have been approved for transfer out of the facility, but their release has been held up. President Obama, who vowed to close Guantanamo, was asked about the hunger strike at a press conference last week and said he did not want these individuals to die. Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the Miami Herald. She's been covering Guantanamo for more than a decade. And Carol, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for the invitation.
How long has this hunger strike been going on?
If you listen to the prisoners and their lawyers, it started on February 6th after a particularly aggressive search of the prisoners' Qurans in a communal prison. If you listen to the military, they say it started a month later after somebody made up that story about the Quran and sort of incited the hunger strike among the other prisoners.
In fact,
so it's either 2 or 3 months old.
And I said 100 people currently on a hunger strike in Guantanamo. Is that correct?
There are, as of this morning, it's an even 100, and it's stood at that by the military's figures for the past 10, 11 days. They've got 24 on the tube being force-fed up to twice a day a can of nutritional supplement, like Ensure. And as of this morning, they've got one getting that force feeding in the hospital. The rest are getting these tube feedings at the prison themselves, I understand, in a separate cell set aside to bring the prisoners there, strap them into a feeding chair, insert this tube up their the nostril, down the back of their throat, into their stomach, and pump in that can up to twice a day. It's a very slow, steady nutritional refeeding, as the military tells us, because otherwise it could make them sick if it went in too quickly.
And when the prisoners talk about this aggressive search, what are you learning? What was entailed in this search that seems so aggressive?
Well, it really is a mystery about what exactly went on February 6th. What the prison had originally said is that they inspected the Qurans every month in the same manner for 10 years. The lawyers had said that, according to the prisoners, over at the communal camp, the showcase camp, the cooperative camp, they hadn't looked inside their Qurans for years. And a new force of guards came, soldiers, and decided to go through the Qurans themselves. The military's position is people could hide weapons in there, holy books, drugs, and other kind of contraband. So really, it's kind of a mysterious episode. If they've always been doing it every month, as the military says, the new military, then I'm not sure what the provocation was. If they hadn't been doing it for years, as the lawyers say and the detainees say, why start? One of the things that just emerged was a sworn statement from an Afghan prisoner on the hunger strike named Obaidullah, long thought to be a cooperative prisoner, not somebody who gave them a hard time, who said he personally saw soldiers rifling through the books. And he uses that expression, which is quite provocative. The military has said up until recently that the soldiers can't even touch the books, that their protocols down there don't allow that, that only a Muslim interpreter, a believer on the payroll of the Pentagon, can inspect the books. But we just heard more recently from the Southcom commander, a four-star Marine general, who says that, as far as he's concerned, it's not desecration if the soldiers do touch the books. He's been given one as a memento himself during our invasion of Iraq. So again, this is a very mysterious episode, but we're now, months later, with 100 men on hunger strike, and everybody agrees that the source here, the problem here, is frustration. Frustration at the lack of transfers. People aren't leaving, even people, as you said, who were cleared for release years ago, both by the Obama administration and in some instances by the Bush administration, to go back to countries that we don't trust to take care of the prisoners. And so they're stuck at Guantanamo.
In fact, just to underscore some of your reporting, that four of the people who are being force-fed today are some of those who have been okayed for release but have been stuck at Guantanamo?
Yes, it's true. See, they don't tell us of the 166 men there, which are cleared for release and which have been designated as forever prisoners, never to be tried, never to be let go. So we know through the lawyers of some of the men who are being force-fed, because they got notice from the Justice Department. And we know from government filings that some of the men were cleared for release because the Justice Department told the court. So we've been able to triangulate and establish that some of these men getting tube feedings, refusing to eat for months so that they are so malnourished that they need tube feedings, actually could have been gone years ago if different policies had been adopted once the CIA, DIA, FBI, State Department, Justice Department all looked at the files and said, these particular men shouldn't be there. But for the fact that in most instances they're Yemeni, we are afraid to send Yemeni prisoners back to Yemen because Al-Qaeda is just so powerful there. Yes, cleared for release and being tube-fed.
Is there something the Obama administration could do besides the president saying that he wants to close this facility? Does he have options at his fingertips?
Well, closure is, I guess, his larger goal. But the real question is if he's got 56 men identified to the courts as good to go, how do you let them go? Congress had already put some restrictions on transfers. The Obama administration earlier had assigned an ambassador who was traveling the world trying to find countries to give resettlement packages to some of these people. But that effort basically hit a brick wall when Europe started saying, why should we take these men if your own Congress won't let you take them to U.S. soil? So I think that the president believes or has articulated that there are potential solutions out there. He did a signing order in I believe it was January, suggesting he has the unilateral power in some instances to transfer people from Gitmo, but they just haven't come up with a formula yet. What we heard from the president in the aftermath of this hunger strike is that he's going to try to find a way to renew this effort. I would tell you that I think that the sign that this is sincere would be if he named somebody prominent to the job of starting to find the solution. Right now, it's not like any single person in his administration is responsible for finding countries to resettle the men who were cleared, both by task force during his presidency and by task force during the Bush presidency.
Do you know when someone is on a hunger strike, and I'm not even thinking about the people who are being force-fed, what they are doing? Is there monitoring of their health, their psychological health, their physical health? What are officials at Guantanamo doing for those who are on a hunger strike?
Okay, I haven't been there for quite a while. Right now they've sort of stopped experienced media tours, but I can tell you from my previous years visiting there that what they do is they send medical staff around to engage them, to try to tell them that, starvation has, the impact of not eating on their health, to talk about malnutrition, to talk about, what will become of them physically. What's going on right now at Gitmo, I was there last month, is that they've got over 100 of these men, more than about 130 of these men under lockdown, each one confined to an individual cell, one man up to 22 hours a day inside his maximum security cell with cameras on him. So they're watching. They're first of all watching because they wanted to figure out who really was hunger striking. The prison had suspected that people were saying they were hunger striking and then sort of snacking on the side. Now the food goes in, the food goes out, or it doesn't, and they know exactly how little these men are eating, so they can monitor it. And then they use a different calculus, meals missed, how sick you are, they weigh people, they've got these guys, it's quite unusual. Inside the clinic at the prison, they've got these signs on the wall that says you calculate a weight by subtracting the weight of the different kind of shackles they have on them when they put them on the scale, and then they figure out what percentage below optimal body weight they are to determine if it is time for one of these tube feedings.
So they're
they had to bring down 40 extra Navy medical workers recently to do this, and they've got a ratio of more than one medic to detainee on a hunger strike at this moment.
So would it be fair to say that they are essentially in solitary confinement while they're on this hunger strike?
They are in solitary situations. The military likes to say it's not solitary confinement because they can speak to each other through the walls of their cells and through the doors. They're on the same corridors where they can hear each other pray, and they are entitled to 2 hours a day in a recreation yard. If they choose, they can be shackled at the wrist and the ankle and brought to a recreation yard, which is fundamentally a cage, where there'll be another detainee probably in the nearby cell, cage-like cell, and then they can engage each other. And that is the basis by which the military says this does not constitute solitary confinement. But it's a very solitary existence.
Have there ever been hunger strikes at Guantanamo?
Yes, there were hunger strikes almost from the start. At the very beginning, when they were in Camp X-Ray, that extremely crude open-air cage-like prison camp they had at the beginning. And frequently, we understand, they're started by some sort of religious tension in which the men are upset or angry over what happened. In the very first one, it started with a actual struggle between a guard and a detainee over whether the detainee could turn his towel into a turban when he prayed. And back then, the conditions were so austere, that was a forbidden activity. The guard went into the cell to rip the turban off the captive's head. And as they told me at the time, way back when in 2002, the guard's foot came in contact with the Quran, and then we had a sudden hunger strike. And the way that one was resolved, which is interesting, is the general in charge of the prison stepped back and thought, what is the issue here? The issue is whether a prisoner can wear his towel as a turban. He went down to the prison and he said, wear your towels as turbans. He reversed on the policy and he said, look, you have to let us look through the turban in case. But he gave a little, something that seemed symbolically important to the men, and that hunger strike stopped overnight. I don't know what they're going to do this time, but there doesn't seem to be at this moment anyone looking for the symbolic thing to give these prisoners to try to end this hunger strike, in part because everyone seems to agree that the thing that would be most likely to end it is if one prisoner were transferred somewhere, that a transfer of somebody already cleared for release could cause people to have hope again.
And Carol, we have to say goodbye in about 30 seconds. Any way to know the effect of the hunger strike on the guards at Guantanamo?
These new guards got there in January. They're MPs, they're soldiers who in many instances had served overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they seem to have been taught a doctrine that teaches that each one of these men is, if not guilty, extremely dangerous and not someone necessarily they should be having compassion for. So it's hard to know to a man individually how these guards view the people that they have been told are functioning to be treated as terrorists, even those that are cleared and have been concluded or not.
Well, Carol, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us an update on the hunger strike at Guantanamo. Thanks a lot, Carol.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Carol Rosenberg, a reporter for the Miami Herald, and has been covering Guantanamo for more than a decade. We'll be talking about some of the medical ethics involved in forced feeding. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, Sir Simon Rattle, and Beethoven. Sir Simon Rattle conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. 215-893-1999 for tickets or at philorg.org. May 16th, 18th, and 19th at the Kimmel Center, Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony with Sir Simon Rattle and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result, well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
This week on This American Life.
Hey, Bill here. Hey, I had a fellow, he was walking. He's walking across the country like a dummy. I frisked him down. He ain't got no gun on him, or no pistol.
Andrew decided to walk across the country interviewing people along the way, which is a premise for a radio story which almost never works. This time it does. This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We just got an update on the hunger strike at Guantanamo from Miami Herald reporter Carol Rosenberg. Now we want to talk about some of the medical ethics raised by force-feeding the legal rights of prisoners to refuse food and drink. And our guests are Jonathan Marks. He's an associate professor of bioethics, humanities, law, and philosophy, also associate director of the Iraq Ethics Institute at Penn State University. Jonathan Marks, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Scott Allen. He's clinical associate professor in the School of Medicine at the University of California at Riverside. He's also an advisor to Physicians for Human Rights, the co-founder of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at Brown University, and the former state medical director of the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. Scott Allen, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Scott, if I could begin with you, and I know both of you were listening in as Carol was describing the hunger strike and the response of administrators at Guantanamo to that hunger strike. From your perspective, Scott, is force feeding a form of prisoner abuse?
Yeah, it certainly can be. The authoritative body on medical ethics is the World Medical Association, and they have a position that's been long established and has been endorsed by the American Medical Association as well, which states that the force feeding of a competent hunger striker is never justified and constitutes a form of inhuman and degrading treatment. That last phrase, inhuman and degrading treatment, is language that was chosen specifically. It does have significance in international torture law and U.S. torture law.
So you see it that way, as a form of torture?
It can rise to that ability, and it's certainly unethical.
Unethical why?
Well, it's a little bit difficult sometimes when people first hear about this to understand the ethical issues at play, but let me describe them briefly. There are two ethical values that come into conflict in the case of a hunger strike in terms of traditional medical ethics. The first is the principle of beneficence, and that is the principle whereby the health professional is to act for the benefit of the patient's health. And that often is interpreted in terms of the obligation to preserve life. The competing ethical value is that of autonomy. Mm-hmm. And that's where the patient has the right to give informed consent for treatment and also has the right to give an informed refusal of treatment. And so when you consider that tradition, which over the last century has sort of emerged as the dominant value in cases where those two values come into conflict, you understand that in the case of a hunger strike, that a informed and competent patient, after hearing the risks and benefits of their situation and the proposed procedure, has a right to refuse an invasive medical procedure.
Jonathan Marks, let me get you in on the conversation. From your perspective, do you see this as a form of prisoner abuse or even torture?
So I hope you weren't hoping for me to disagree with my colleague Scott, because I absolutely agree. I mean, I think it's notable that, you know, the World Medical Association, which has produced a number of declarations dealing with this, in one of the declarations, the Declaration of Tokyo, it's the language of torture and cruel and human and degrading treatment is used in that declaration. And then, indeed, there's a separate declaration of Malta focusing on force feeding. So I agree that in some cases it will likely be inhuman and degrading treatment, and in more extreme cases, as the European Court of Human Rights has recognized, it will rise to the level of torture. And so it depends on exactly how it is being done. But the again, I sort of endorse Scott's sort of interpretation about the importance of autonomy and beneficence and what that might mean, but it's important to add that, you know, one of the arguments that's so commonly used to defend force feeding is, you know, we want to make sure that detainees don't die.
Right.
And, you know, if you are having to remove somebody from a cell using force and then strap them into a 6 or 8 point restraint to force feed them, that's clearly somebody who has such sufficient physical strength that you couldn't even begin to argue that their health was currently impaired.
let me pick up on several things that the both of you had said. And I'm wondering about the medical personnel, perhaps even Jonathan, I'll start with you. So is the prisoner their patient? Is it their prisoner? Is that a complicated relationship for a person who's a medical personnel who's doing the force feeding?
So it's absolutely a complicated relationship. And I would say that things have been made more complex because of the history of health professionals in aggressive interrogation at Guantanamo Bay. So in any event, if we left that aside for the moment, the problem from the point of view of a detainee is that they look at a military health professional as essentially an agent of the U.S. government and the administration and the military. And so that in itself is one problem, building a relationship of trust and confidence between a detainee and a health professional. But that is exacerbated by the point I just mentioned, which is that there has been a history of the involvement of health professionals in aggressive interrogations. And so that undermines trust between the physician and the patient even more.
Well, Scott, just picking up on that, does that indicate that those people who are doing the force feeding at Guantanamo are violating medical ethics?
Well, unfortunately, it's pretty clear that they are, because the medical ethics are rather clear in this case. But we should take a moment to think about the very difficult position the health professionals have been placed in. And take a step back from the issue of hunger strikes for a moment and think about how difficult it is to be assigned as a health professional working in any detention setting. Whereas Jonathan says, you're rightfully seen as an agent of the institution that's holding you from the patient's point of view. And also remember, what everyone understands about medicine in the community is medicine and the practice of medicine is based on trust. So if you don't establish a foundation of trust, medical care cannot take place. So this is a challenge for any doctor walking into any prison anywhere. And you start behind the eight ball and you work very hard to establish trust. You asked, are these detainees patients or are they prisoners or
right.
detainees? From the doctor's point of view, it's clear they are patients. And the primary obligation is to act in the interest of the patient and respect their autonomy and medical ethics. So that doesn't change. But there is this built-in conflict baked into the pie because the health professionals that are deployed to such settings are uniformed in answer to a non-medical chain of command. And so that sets up this predictable conflict.
And the idea of do you work for the institution or are you essentially there for the care of the patient/prisoner, Scott?
That's right. So again, as I say, the primary obligation is the professional one and you are there for the patient. But as Jonathan says, this conflict produces situations that the well gets poisoned and then mm-hmm. other things that were done further cloud the situation and make it increasingly difficult for clinicians to engage in meaningful therapeutic relationships with the patient. And that's important because the World Medical Association guidelines are not some sort of idealistic ethical guidelines. They were designed by people who had a great deal of experience in negotiating successful ends to hunger strikes and detention settings. But they understood that for the physician to play a meaningful role, the patient had to trust the physician. So it's built on a principle of respect and therapeutic approach and actually is about life preservation. The problem is that because of certain missteps, including the deployment of health professionals in interrogations, which further eroded trust, perhaps irreparably, the only option left has been the use of brute force.
Mm. Is it possible, do you think, Scott Allen, for a medical professional to do the force feeding and also try to develop a relationship of, if not trust, at least of confidence with a patient, or do those things just contradict each other?
I think they fundamentally contradict each other. We're talking about use of force feeding in someone who is competent. Note, we haven't talked about this in detail, but if someone is incompetent by mental illness or other condition, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who have been deemed to be competent to make their own decisions, and then that decision is mm-hmm. not only not respected, it's violated in a very physical way with a very uncomfortable, invasive procedure. So that pretty much, you have to sort of put yourself in the patient's position. How much would you trust the doctor who participated in such an act against you. I think it would destroy trust.
And that's Scott Allen. He's clinical associate professor in the School of Medicine at the University of California at Riverside, co-founder of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at Brown University. Also with us, Jonathan Marks. He's an associate professor of bioethics, humanities, law, and philosophy at Penn State University. We're talking about the hunger strike at Guantanamo and the fact that something like 24 prisoners are now being force-fed there. There has been a protest, a hunger strike going on for several months now, and we're talking about whether prisoners have the right to refuse food and water, and apparently they do. What do you think about this? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jonathan Marks, going back to you, and I'm going back to the press conference last week where President Obama was asked about the hunger strike, and one of the things he said is, I don't want these individuals to die, and clearly he does not, but it seems to me, and perhaps this is more a political question, it does raise a whole host of questions for the president about what he could potentially do to end this hunger strike.
Yeah, so I'm obviously sympathetic to the expression of the concern that nobody wants a prisoner to die. But what we also have to recognize is we have put these people in a position in which, you know, they're the only option left to them to express their extreme frustration at being detained without trial for 11 years is to refuse to eat. So the president is in a position where he really has to, you know, take very seriously where we go now. And I should add that, you know, but for this hunger strike, I don't think the state of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay would have been so much in the forefront of American consciousness. I mean, the nation had essentially forgotten about the detainees. And this hunger strike has served the purpose of putting them on the map. And so, really, I think the president is having his hand forced a little, in some ways, to put his money where his mouth is and to really think seriously about transferring and releasing detainees who've been approved for transfer and release a very long time ago.
But would you say then hunger strikes are a very effective form of protest?
So it's that's a terrific question. I recall under the Bush administration when there was a hunger strike in 2006, the response of the administration was, this is asymmetric warfare on the part of the hunger strikers. And in the same breath, and we don't want the detainees to die. And that's a very problematic characterization, because you can't really be thinking about the welfare of detainees if you consider their behavior to be a form of asymmetric warfare. So that sort of mindset really has to be taken out of the picture.
Because, Scott Allen, it seems, I mean, these prisoners, they are putting their life on the lines for their cause, for their protest.
Right, and that's a good way of stating it. You know, we haven't talked about another common misunderstanding, which is what is a hunger strike, and as we've already said, it is a form of protest, as Jonathan just described. But what it isn't is an attempt at suicide, and what you just said reminds me of this point, because the protester is undertaking an act on behalf of a cause they deeply care about, and there's a willingness to put their health and life at risk, but that's not their intent. So if there were some concessions or there were some negotiations or some of their demands were met, they would be more than happy to return to eat. You know, they want to live in a better world, not die in it.
In fact, one of the prisoners reportedly told his New York lawyer, and I'm quoting from the New York Times here, he's quoted as saying, I do not want to kill myself. My religion prohibits suicide, but I will not eat or drink until I die, if necessary, to protest the injustice of this place. We want to get out of this place. Just to underscore, Scott Allen, what you just said.
And if I can add, it's important to understand that, and you know, as a doctor who's advised people in hunger strike settings and has managed some clinical situations myself in my career, the relative roles of security and medical often get confused. And so it's important to understand that this is primarily an act of protest with which does have significance to security situation. But it often gets handed off like a hot potato to medical staff, and medical staff are directed to solve the problem. Well, the fundamental root cause is the condition of confinement. It has medical consequences, and physicians can be very helpful in informing the patient about the risks of their actions and potential solutions and options that would reduce risk and preserve life. But physicians shouldn't be asked to sort of solve the problem, and the root problem, as it were, is the conditions of confinement. That's wholly in the control of the detaining authority.
And Jonathan Marks, Carol Rosenberg was talking about the fact that a number of these people on a hunger strike are now being held. She said not the military doesn't use the word solitary confinement, but held in solitary cells for 22 hours a day. Adding that on top of the strike and then the forced feeding, does that just add to the misery?
I certainly think it adds to the misery, and that, you know, what you've essentially done then is you've taken detainees who are protesting about their conditions, and you've just made their conditions worse rather than better. So that, to me, doesn't seem like a solution.
But do you think, and even based on what Carol was telling us about how leadership at Guantanamo dealt with previous hunger strikes, what do you think the leadership, the administrators at Guantanamo, Jonathan Marks, what can they do? Because they don't make the decision about release of prisoners. They're there just to monitor them.
So you raised some really important questions about what the people on the ground can do. And I would actually say that I think there's a real role for allowing the detainees for the moment to have access to independent physicians who are not military physicians, health professionals who are not attached to the military, so that they can talk through with people whom they may be in a better position to trust the implications of what they're doing. I think that's one thing that can be done on the ground. And those physicians could really work with the detainees to get a sense of what they might do in order to alleviate the conditions. So there are certain other things that could be done other than force feeding that might prevent some of the long-term permanent damage that can result from hunger striking.
Such as?
So I would actually defer to a physician on this because I'm not a physician. But my understanding is that you can give certain minerals and vitamin supplements that can help prolong life and prevent serious damage. I don't know whether Scott's in a better position to comment on that than I am, but a health professional will tell you that there are things you can do. I mean, a health professional could also work with detainees to find out who really does want to hunger strike and who may be feeling sort of coercion from fellow detainees, which is also something that you would want to establish. But the idea that a physician who is seen as an agent of the U.S. military might be able to do that is rather challenging, and so one could see the role for independent health professionals.
Well, let me take a very short break, and then Scott Allen, I'll have you respond to that. Talking with Scott Allen and Jonathan Marks about the hunger strike at Guantanamo and also the fact that something like 24 of the detainees at Guantanamo are being forced fed. Jonathan Marks, an associate professor of bioethics, humanities, law, and philosophy at Penn State University, and Scott Allen, clinical associate professor in the School of Medicine at the University of California at Riverside. He's also the co-founder of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at Brown University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Where do you stand on this issue? Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view May 10th through June 2nd, the 112th Annual Student Exhibition with over 1,000 works of art by PAFA's accomplished students. PAFA's annual student exhibition showcases a diversity of style, combining traditional skill and contemporary vision. An opportunity to view and acquire early works by the artists who may become the art world's next big stars. Details at 215-972-7600 or pafa.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, how Wall Street defanged Dodd-Frank. Gary Rivlin tells us how this Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was signed into law 3 years ago, has subsequently been attacked and weakened by financial industry lobbyists and lawyers. It's the subject of Rivlin's article in The Nation. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Remember the days when gas cost $1.50 a gallon? That's how cheap it is now to fill up with natural gas. Drivers are doing it, but pumps are few and far between. Also, movie stars accused of co-opting Kickstarter to fund projects. Is it time to call it Rich Starter? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We got an update on the hunger strike, the forced feeding at Guantanamo. Now we're talking about some of the medical ethics raised by forced feeding and the rights of prisoners to refuse food and water. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Scott Allen, do you like that idea of outside medical personnel, in a sense, being someone that a prisoner could talk to?
Absolutely. I and others have been recommending that for some time. As I stated, you know, the military health professionals that have been assigned there are really in a very difficult position. And by the way, we should say, in my experience, most of the people who serve in uniform in the medical corps are really quite professional, highly trained, mission-driven people. Understand that the conflict we're talking about is really baked into their assignment, U.S. policy, and so forth. So their hands are largely tied, and they are asked to act primarily as instruments of the state, and their ability to act as independent and autonomous clinicians is somewhat limited. That being the case, one potential partial solution, and it's only a partial solution, is to create opening for outside independent clinicians, probably and ideally clinicians that have been chosen with the assistance of the detainee's attorney so that there is a better baseline trust as they enter. To enter into the type of therapeutic dialogue that some of the military clinicians aren't able to do effectively, again, based on their institutional conflict, not necessarily their personal conflict.
And what if these medical personnel, what if they refuse to do this? What kind of questions would that raise for you, Scott Allen?
What, could you be a little clearer? Are you talking about the uniformed professionals if they refuse to force feed?
Yes.
Well, that would create a conflict and push this whole thing to another level. But, and I don't know this for sure, but there have certainly been reports in the media over the years, and I've heard in discussions that there is some screening of personnel assigned to Guantanamo such that doctors and other health professionals who say, look, if you send me to Guantanamo, I can't violate my medical ethics. The Navy has said, well, fine, then you won't be assigned to Guantanamo. That's a nice accommodation for individual professionals who are concerned about acting within medical ethics, but also you realize sort of the bizarre world it sets up where the only people who are being assigned are people who say, well, I don't feel like I have to follow that ethic and I'm willing to serve this mission. So it really creates, you know, again, it just exacerbates the problem.
Indeed. Let me get, looks like Dennis from Abington to join us on Radio Times. And Dennis, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
My question's simple. From what I understood, the Navy was in charge of the security of Gitmo for a while, and I don't know how long, but things were fairly peaceful at that time. And then there was a transition. Maybe it was the Army who comes in, and then there's a certain amount of, you know, discontent. Why can't simply recognize that and make adjustments, take some responsibility, make some adjustments, and move forward?
You're saying who should make the adjustments, Dennis?
The American government. I mean, if we were having a successful system there when the Navy was patrolling, was involved in the security of Gitmo, then obviously it had something to do with that transition of the Guard that created the issue that's we're presently experiencing there.
Well,
aside from the ethical issues, I mean, there was a moment there where we had a conflict.
Well, and what we heard from Carol Rosenberg is there is a difference of opinion about how Qurans were handled or not, and I think that's part of the complicating factor. Jonathan Marks, anything you want to say in response to Dennis's comment?
So, I mean, it is possible, and those who've had access to Guantanamo Bay and I have not, may be able to talk about changes in the circumstances on the ground, but I think whatever fine-tuning our caller might suggest, you don't eliminate the fundamental problem, which is that these are people who have been detained for 11 years And they just can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So until you address that problem, I don't see how you can bring hunger striking to an end.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, because I know there were hunger strikes in Britain. Bobby Sands famously had his hunger strike. And I wonder whether in Britain, and I'm only asking you this because you have a British accent, whether Britain did something to address this problem.
So I think, you know, the case of Bobby Sands is a really sort of interesting example because he was an IRA terrorist who was insisting that he be treated as a, you know, as a prisoner of war rather than a criminal. So it's a slightly different scenario. I mean, I think that the important thing here is to recognize that we have something incredibly unusual in the U.S. We have more than 100 detainees who are 100 of whom are on hunger strike who are being held in a place to which they were sent precisely because it was considered an ideal legal black hole beyond the reach of the law. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that cannot be the case. But this is, this is sui generis. It's hard to point to. We've never had anything in the UK that looks remotely like this. We tried, I should add, the UK government tried, to defend for a time this role of indefinite detention of international terrorists. And our, what we now call the Supreme Court, but used to be called the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, our court basically said, if you believe the detention of terrorists is so important, and you cannot confine that detention to those who are non-citizens, you'd have to be prepared to do it to everyone. Otherwise, it is discriminatory. And at that moment, indefinite detention in the UK essentially no longer became a possibility.
Interesting. Let me go back to you, Scott Allen, just to underscore the fact that a number of many of the detainees at Guantanamo have not been charged and are ready for release. They are really living in this judicial legal limbo.
Well, that's correct. And I think it's important always to go back to the root cause, which are the conditions of confinement, and that particularly those who have been cleared for release, and they're being held in an indefinite state. I think we can all intuitively understand, but there also is a literature to support, that people in that situation experience a deal of psychological distress. And remember, interesting thing to me as someone who's studied and considered and experienced working in hunger strike situations is that it really all comes down to this issue of autonomy. And I'm not speaking so much of the ethical principle, but the autonomy itself. That people don't undertake this form of protest, and certainly not in a prolonged way, lightly. And they don't undertake it when there are other options. So it's when they're painted into the corner and it appears to be the only option left. So again, the legal system has not been responsive or is not truly available. Other supports internally, grievance processes and so forth. So they're sort of painted into a corner and it's really the last thing they control. Sadly, in those situations, the detention authorities, who already control almost everything, get rather obsessed about controlling that very last piece of autonomy the individual has. And it turns into sort of a vicious cycle, and the relationship further deteriorates.
And I should
That's why, just therapeutically, it's so important to get someone who can reestablish trust with the detainee and work with them on a commonly agreed upon plan as a way out.
And you were the state medical director for the Rhode Island Department of Corrections, assuming that you had to deal with hunger strikes or individual hunger strikes when you were in that position.
Well, yes. The qualification, though, to state the obvious, is that they were rare in my setting. They typically involved one patient, and we did highly individualized interventions. You know, the interesting thing about Guantanamo is that in the modern era, it's really unprecedented. You might even say it's unprecedented in history altogether, to the extent that it has been sort of mechanized. You did mention briefly, or I think Carol might have at the beginning, the use of these restraint chairs. The use of restraint chairs, these are chairs that were designed originally for the correctional setting around security issues not related to hunger strikes, to just restrain inmates who were acting out physically. And they actually fell out of favor of use in U.S. Corrections because of injuries related to them. Often if you're traumatized and then immobilized, you can form blood clots and even get pulmonary emboli. And indeed, several patients died in these chairs. So they fell out of favor in corrections, and they were collecting dust somewhere. When the early hunger strikes started up at Guantanamo, and someone got the idea that they'd buy some of these chairs and use them in restraining detainees at Guantanamo for force feeding. This has no corollary in the domestic U.S. in the management of hunger strikers, or in the feeding or restraint of anyone who requires a forced intervention. Mm. So, you know, we've sort of really brought it up, larger numbers of people, and also understand World Medical Association, when it said force feeding is not appropriate, was really contemplating sort of a one-time issue. This idea of some of these hunger strikers have been on hunger strike before, some of them have been on hunger strike for a very prolonged period, so this really prolonged, repeated force feeding over weeks, months, and sometimes even over years at this scale is somewhat unprecedented.
Let me get Tina from Villanova to join our conversation. And Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi there.
For taking my call.
You're welcome.
My comment is, as a physician and an American, I'm horrified that we are perpetrating this on anyone. I'm reading Atul Gawande right now. He's a surgeon who
sure.
writes about medical ethics, and he's actually commented on this, on being a part as a healthcare worker, being a part of this sort of thing, and actually being the people to put to death those condemned to death. And he says the ethics are clear that even though doctors may say that they're trying to make things as comfortable as possible for the condemned prisoner, if they refuse to do it, which they should ethically, maybe we wouldn't have capital punishment. Maybe something could be done about that fundamental wrong. And in this case, too, we should take a prisoner in the position of being so.
You know, Tina, I'm sorry to do this only because we are losing you, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I want to give Jonathan Marks a chance to respond to that. And she's saying she's horrified as an American, as a physician, and raising this question about physicians, perhaps, or medical personnel refusing to involve themselves in this situation.
So I, like Scott, had heard at a previous time that the military was sort of screening health professionals to make sure that they didn't have conscientious objection to force feeding of health professionals at Guantanamo Bay. I don't know whether the three dozen health professionals, medical corpsmen, nurses, and others who've been sent out to Guantanamo Bay have confirmed that they'd be happy to do it or not. But I agree with Scott that this is a moment for them to speak out if they want to express, as I think they should, their ethical concerns. But I'm also aware that, you know, we have a number of people in the military, health professionals, who go into to military medical service for very laudable reasons. They go because they want to provide care, usually to other soldiers, without worrying about their ability to pay, which is what a physician in the private sector has to worry about. So I, like Scott, want to endorse that, you know, there are a lot of health professionals who go into the military to provide medical service with the most laudable of ideals. And that what the military has to bear in mind is that we shouldn't put people in situations unnecessarily where we undermine that will to serve. So I suspect that there are a number of health professionals at Guantanamo Bay who are not comfortable doing this. And I would urge them to speak up and speak out, and I would urge the military to support them and endorse them in their expression of their desire to express fidelity to their, not just their own personal ethical commitments, but to the international codes of ethics on force feeding.
Well, it would be interesting if they did that, if the president would underscore their particular protest.
Well, it's, you know, what's interesting is you see this in other areas. So there was a famous case a number of years ago in California where the court said that the death penalty could only be administered with the involvement of anesthetists. And, of course, when some anesthetists refused to get involved, that meant the death penalty couldn't go ahead. So in actual fact, you know, this is, force feeding is only possible because health professionals are participating in force feeding. The idea that the military would force feed without the use of health professionals, I think, would be untenable to them. And so health professionals should recognize that they are actually also, unfortunately, facilitating mm-hmm. the process.
And, Scott, we're almost out of time here, but I was reading about an Indian political activist, a woman who has been protesting since November 2000, and for 500 weeks she has been force-fed by a tube.
Well, so there are other extreme cases out there. I think I'd only respond by saying that there's an individual case versus we're talking the involvement here of, as reported, about 100 hunger strikers are really fundamentally different situations.
And do you think, Scott, I mean, there, as you both have said, this is getting needed attention. Do you think that will help deal with the situation in Guantanamo?
Well, I certainly hope so. Again, you know, all I would say, and I've been in dialogue, and both Jonathan and I have participated in meetings and discussions with involved parties going back years, but there has been some degree of stubbornness in saying this is the best way, this force feeding is the best way to approach this. And I'd say, well, how's it worked out for you?
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Scott Allen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Marks, thank you very much as well.
Thank you indeed.
And Jonathan Marks, Associate Professor of Bioethics, Humanities, Law, and Philosophy at Penn State University, where he is Associate Director of the Iraq Ethics Institute. Scott Allen, Clinical Associate Professor in the School of Medicine at the University of California at Riverside, and advisor to Physicians for Human Rights and co-founder of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at Brown University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. And do